Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, RunCatalina.com, ATV Swim Spas, the official training vessel of six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. This last year, we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. One of our favorite guys, he is in the Ironman Triathlon Hall of Fame, recently inducted with his wife, Sue, into the Triathlon Canada Hall of Fame. His name is Graham Fraser. Graham, how the heck you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. I'm actually up in Penticton, where all that Ironman stuff started. So it's kind of fitting we're having a conversation as I'm looking at where the swim happened.
Oh, is that right? You're looking out at the swim there. God, that's such a classic race. So was when you first got into the event business, you had been a competitor. What brought you into putting on events?
Well, actually, it always goes back to me. Like, I was a hockey player. And in 1985, I actually put on a bike-a-thon to raise money for the local junior hockey team. And, you know, I didn't mean it to be a business, but I just wanted to raise some money. I had done the Ironman in Hawaii in 1984, and I was talking with our Parks and Rec director about after the bike-a-thon, what do we do now? And I said, why don't we put on a triathlon? I just did this thing in Hawaii, and we could put on a triathlon. So anyway, long story short, we ended up putting on the triathlon, and Sue was the summer student he gave me to help. So from the Parks Department.
That's how we met. I didn't know that's how you met. That's funny.
Oh yeah, yeah. So she worked with me, and we put on the first race, and in Grimsby, Ontario, in 1986, and had 300 people, and we cut it off at 300, and put on the event. It went really well, and then a couple other towns who had people at the event called me up and said, "Hey, there was no sport back then." They said, "We'd like to have one of those in our town because we're a tourist town." And so I ended up meeting in Orillia, Ontario, the mayor up there, and he sent me around town to meet some of the business people, and Royal LePage Real Estate was a big real estate company, and I met the manager, and he loved the idea, and he took me to Toronto with him, and we met the big board guys in their suits, and I was a 25-year-old kid, and I was pitching this idea to do a little series of material. And in one meeting, they said, let's do it. And so we ended up getting a sponsor, and away we went, and had to go find venues and create some races, and that's how we kind of birthed the series in Ontario in 1986.
Yeah, and so you had a five-race series in Ontario, then the first Canadian Championships in 88. And then World Championships, ITU World Championships, Muskoka. That's jumping to another level when you start putting on a World Championship.
Yeah, that was our first really big event and foray into, we had in 88 we did television in Canada and stuff like that, so... It was, but we got involved with the politics and Les McDonald and the ITU and the bidding and, the TV rights around the world. So, I was a young guy, Les used to always call me green. Oh, you're so green. And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Now I understand it now that I'm older, what he was meaning by how green I was. But, it was a wonderful experience. And, just to see 1,800 athletes from around the world at that event, it was magical. And again, it was an apprenticeship. That's where you learn. When you're an event director, you have to put yourself out there in uncomfortable places, and that's where you kind of learn, which really laid the foundation for us to learn how we could possibly get into the Ironman business down the road. We didn't know that was coming, but it was part of it.
Okay, and then the Ironman business. Ironman Canada had been in Penticton. At least I think it had been in Penticton.
It was in Penticton.
It was in Penticton, but it was hurting financially, and you came in and basically saved that event, I think.
Well, I don't think I was the one to say. There's a guy named Michael Bregman from Toronto who came in the mid-90s when the event was financially in disarray, and he put $250,000 into the event because the entry fees all disappeared, because I think what was happening, they were robbing Peter to pay Paul as the event was going, and eventually you run out of money.
Right,
like you're getting the entry fees, but it was paying the old bills, and there's no money to put the event on. So that's the event was in crisis mode, and some of the local people went around the community and did some fundraising, and I think they raised, I don't know the exact number they raised, but they raised some money. And then Michael Bregman, well, he was an athlete at the time, and Michael said, well, I'll put in the money, $250,000 to keep it going, but I'll be the owner then. Like, I'll take over ownership. And that's kind of, and Michael was one of my sponsors of my local races in Ontario and did all our races. So I got to know him a bit. And he approached me in 1995 and said, well, you know, he was having trouble with the locals and making it work. And he said, why don't we move the event to Muskoka, Ironman Canada, and I'll give you 50% ownership. I'm like, great. And you run it. And I thought, that's awesome. In the meantime, two people from Penticton flew out to Ontario to meet me because they were, Michael said, well, I'll tell you what, go meet Graham Fraser. What he wants to do is what we'll do. So they flew out, met me, and the one promise I gave him is I'll fly to Penticton and I'll check out the community because I'd never been to Penticton. So I actually came out in 1995 and they put this big reception on. There was like 100 people in this restaurant. And I could see the beauty there and I could see the passion for the event. And, you know, and I just thought, wow, this place is magical. So, I went back to Michael and said, look, I think it should stay in Penticton. What do you think it should take as well? He says, well, I don't really want to be involved, but if you want to do it in Penticton, just give me my $250,000 back, pay me back, and you do what you want with it.
Oh, my God. Just give me $250K. Yeah, which you had laying around.
Yeah, I had that laying around. So I went back to my wife and I said, look, you know, it's always a joke. I said to Sue, look, you know, it's going to cost us $250,000 to buy an event that loses $100,000 a year. What do you think?
So that is a classic. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I delved into their financials and their books, and I thought I could get my Ontario-based sponsors and the people I had with me to come out. And I don't know why, but I had a sense that there was something there. I think, you know, I just, seeing how the series and the sport was going, I thought there's something here. There's something with this Ironman thing. I think there's something's going to explode here. And,
right.
And so we did the deal and we gave Michael his money back and, you know, came out. And then I found out there was $100,000 in debt that nobody actually knew in the book. So we were $350,000 in.
Wow.
Before we even put our first event on.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, I didn't have $250,000 lying around. Like that was like basically, you know, you're leveraging everything you've got.
Sure.
To do it. But it turned around really quickly. And the other part of the story that I went to David Gates, who's still a good friend, and said, David, you know, because David, I was a professional ITP to the Pro Tour commissioner at the
right.
time. So I'd been working with David a lot on that whole political thing against ITU. And so David and I became very close, and he wanted me to take over Ironman Canada. One of the reasons I did do it, because David was pushing me to take over Ironman Canada. Like he said, you know, we need you to take this event over and fix it, save it, do whatever. So I'm getting it from both ends. So I went to David and said, look, I don't mind. I'll put the money in. I'll do it. I'll take the risk. But I don't want you to start putting Ironmans on everywhere and put me out of business and, you know, and lose my investment.
Right.
So I proposed. I said, well, you know, why don't you just do this? Like, if there's going to be any events in North America, I have the rights to them. And David at the time didn't think they were going to do any events in North America. But they signed that and, you know, we got that into the deal. So that's what gave us the rights to do the Ironman.
Well, and what's great about that is at that point, there was Ironman World Championship in Kona, and then there was other Ironmans, New Zealand, et cetera, around the world, and Canada. But there was nothing in mainland, in the rest of North America. There was nothing in the U.S. mainland.
No.
For you to have that vision and think, you know what, there's this thing, there's possibilities that this thing's going to grow, and I don't want them to start an Ironman in, you know, Seattle or something that's going to be competitive with me.
Right. That's what it was. It was more of a defensive mode, but also a sense that I just could feel it. You know, when you live and breathe a sport, you do it every day, you kind of get a sense of where it might go.
Exactly.
But, you know, we weren't sure. We had no idea. And, like, you know, when we started Lake Placid, you know, it's another one of those funny stories.
Yeah,
it's
so how did that
you know,
come
Ken
about?
I went to, Lou and I, we had no idea if anybody was going to come. We had zero idea. And I committed to license fees at WTC at the time. And so I took the risk again.
Placid reach out to you originally for, you know, because at that point, again, there was no events in the mainland USA. How did that all come about?
Oh, when Penticton started to sell out and do well, and it turned around very quickly. Like Penticton, we turned it around. We brought in sponsors. We brought in TV. The athletes started coming, you know, and, you know, they were sleeping in sleeping bags to get into their race, you know, at that point. We went, I was going to that to WTC. So look, there's a need for another race here. It was we were kind of pushing it, saying there's a, like, we're not, you know, the athletes are really being upset that they can't get into Canada. We right. need another race in North America. And Lou, I think, convinced the board to give it a shot. So I was actually, ironically, I was still putting on my triathlon series in Ontario at the same time we were doing Ironman Canada. And I just, Sue and I just decided to let my brother take it over because, you know, we just were, you know, we'd done it 13 years. It was every weekend and and we were putting our energy all into the Ironman. So I just thought, oh, finally, I'm just going to have a life again. Like, we're going to put on our Ironman, get rid of the series, I'm going to have a life. Literally within 2 weeks of making that decision, Lou phones me up and says, okay, you've got the rights to go do an American race. Go find a spot. And I'm like, I was playing golf with my university roommates, and I just looked at him and said, that just changed my life. That call just changed my life. I just knew that was going to start something. And so we literally that weekend loaded up our big Ford Expedition with our kids and all our sports equipment, and we were going on a tour around the Northeast U.S. because that's what we had figured we'd start. And the first place we went was Lake Posset. Kevin McKinnon, who you know.
Yeah, very well.
You know, we were talking and said, well, we did the little map. We're going to go to Burlington, Vermont. We're going to all these places. And he said, but Lake Posset is one of those spots that, you know, you got to check out first. So that's where we started. And in the first 10 minutes in that town, I was there. I was like, oh, my God. Like, you know, this is an unbelievable venue. And then I went for Brian Delaney at High Peak Cyclery. I went into his bike shop, and he gave me some routes to do. The first bike ride I did on my bike was actually with the Ironman bike course is. And it still is to this day. And then I went out and did a run that morning, the next morning, and I ran on River Road, which is the run course. The swim was the swim. You could see it.
Right.
And I went back to the mayor. And, you know, he called a meeting with all the officials. And I love this story, but it's, I started doing my little dog and pony about what Ironman is. And literally within 5 minutes, Mayor Strack stands up, pounds his fist on the table, and says, we're doing it. Like, that was it.
That was it.
5 minutes. That was it. 5 minutes. It took 5 minutes. They said, we're doing it. Like, you know, and I'm like, really? He says, yep. And then we started talking about the planning and the, you know, what we needed to do to get the venues and this and that. And there was no permit process back then. They actually said, well, we don't have permits. You just write up something and we'll sign it.
Wow.
That was the permit.
I love that.
So, and 5 days later, we signed a contract. We announced the event 5 days after. It was always five. It was after 5 days, we announced the event, and then 5 days later, it was full.
Oh, wait. It was sold out?
And we went, sold out.
Oh, my God.
5 days, it sold out.
And we're
sold
talking...
out back that those days was 1,500 people.
Well, but like, and also, it's not like, was there online registration at that point?
Yeah, I can't even tell you how we did it. I can't remember the truth of it. I don't know if it was online or paper, but it just filled up right away. The demand, the hotel rooms filled up in town right away. Like, boom. Like, the businesses were like, oh, my God.
This
like,
is great.
You know, all the phones were ringing. And that's when Lou and I went back and I said, oh, my God, there is something here. And then we said, well, we better get another one going. And that became Ironman Florida. Like, I literally, you know, right away started looking. We didn't even have a staff, by the way. We didn't have people to put this on. We didn't, like, we had, like, five people. Like, so next thing you know, we're doing, like, I mean, it was like, we worked like slaves. Like, that's all you did all day, every day. To pull off those events, and I thought we were planning Florida the next year. Lou goes, no, let's do it this year. And I'm like, are you kidding? Like,
wait. So you're doing Placid in June or July, and he's saying let's do it this November.
November, and we ended up doing it. He actually did it the same year. So, and, you know, no infrastructure, no anything. You know, you got to come up with 3,000 or 4,000 volunteers. But I flew down. The reason we picked Panama City is because they already had the Gulf Coast Triathlon, and they had some semblance of an infrastructure.
Right.
And athletes knew the place, and that's where Shelley got involved with me. You know Shelley Bramblett.
Yes.
You know, she was the first volunteer paid. She was not paid. She was the volunteer director who ended up being the race director. But we ended up pulling off those first two races.
So what?
And as you know, California was the next spring.
Oh, at Pendleton.
At Pendleton. It was the next spring.
What I remember is being at a meeting with Lou Friedland, president of Ironman, with the commander and on the base.
Yeah.
And first driving onto the base and Lou going, oh, my God, look at all the helicopters. And do they own all this land? And then we sat in there and Lou showed the video, and I think the commander was crying. And
Colonel Smith.
Colonel Smith. And we did a story on him standing on the tank and the whole bit. And Colonel Smith said, you know, Lou said, Colonel, just so you understand, we are a pain in the ass, right? We're going to come in and block off your roads. Every other place we go, they've got, you know, they've got restaurants, they've got hotels. There's a reason for them to put this on. You really don't have that. Are you sure you want to go through this? And he goes, listen, we want to be good neighbors for Oceanside and Carlsbad and San Clemente. Yeah. And that was it. But what was when you look at your formula of Coeur d'Alene and Arizona and Florida, I look at those and I go, what's great about those, they're all places that have hotels. They're all destination communities. But they're also small enough where you can dominate, where you can sort of be, you're off-Broadway.
Yeah.
It's not New York City, which, as we found, was not a great place to do it. Is that what you looked for?
Well, there's a few things that we look for. First of all, the most important thing is the swim, bike, and run have to work.
Yes.
And in my mind, it had to be like an A swim and an A bike and an A run. Like, you know, you don't want to swim in places people don't want to swim. You want the lake to be where the venue is, first of all. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, you can have two transition races and all that. And in Camp Pendleton, originally they wanted a two transition race. You know, where we do everything up by all the buildings are. And I looked at it and said, no way, we're going to do it right down at the beach. We're going to set up our own city. We're going to build our city, which was, you know, a really cool, that's what made that event cool, is we put up all the tents. The military guys made their own little restaurants, like
right.
The tents. It was a really cool thing. So I wanted everyone together. Like everyone would, you know, we could walk everywhere. You see everything. There's an energy, all those type of things. And then you want to be, to me, you want to be in communities that you want to, I always judge it. If I wanted to take my family there for a vacation, that was a good thing.
Yeah.
If people want a vacation destination, they want a place where the kids are going to come with the mom or dad, whoever's not, you know, and they're going to hang out, and you're going to own the place. Like when you walked into Lake Placid, I mean, I'll never forget driving around Lake Placid the first year, and you came around by the arena, and I was in the lead car, and it's like the Tour de France with all the spectators. You're going, that's what athletes want. You want to feel like you're doing something unique and special. You go to a big city, it's hard to get them engaged because there's so many events there. Like, you're not the big guy. But when you're, even in Madison was the next step up to a bigger place.
Right.
And that's still, they still bought into it. There were still spectators there. There were still whatever. So then we went to Arizona, which was the next level up, like to Tempe. And, you know, every place that got bigger and bigger was harder to get spectators and to get that feeling.
That's true.
So to me, the best location, and I think the test of time is, you know, and I don't really follow the sport that much anymore, but I still think the venues that were the right venues still are the best races and fill up the fastest and have the best atmosphere.
That's,
you know,
really
I think
true.
Those ones are, I could be wrong, but I think
Florida, Placid, Arizona, those are the ones that fill up the fastest. And it's funny too, because I think the ultimate oxymoron is when you say easy Ironman. But people want to be part of the Ironman family, and they don't really want to be climbing up Mount Everest, right? So when you look at Florida and you look at Arizona, yes, it's still 140.6 miles, but it's something that the average person with some dedication can get through. Was that important to you, that these not
became a mass event, right?
You're right.
Like, you know, back in the, you know, when we raced in the mid-'80s and all that, it was a very niche sport. Everybody was a higher-end level athlete.
Right.
You know, that started. It's just like marathon running. Like the average marathon time is way slower now than it used to be because you've got the masses. So you have to design courses that are a little more user-friendly, still challenging. But I agree with you. Like, you know, I did Ironman Florida as an athlete. It was one of the hardest ones I did because I sat on my bike for 112 miles using the same muscles and the same back position. You know, like, there's nothing easy about it. Like, and again, if you want to go fast, fast hurts no matter what you're doing.
That's true.
Like, it doesn't matter what the course is. So, yeah, I agree. I mean, and so you try and design a variety of different venues for different type of athletes. I, you know, like, you cannot, to me, beat like Placid or Penticton to ride that bike course and go through all the vineyards in Penticton and the mountains. Like, you know, so that's another type of event. There are, like, my brother did Ironman Florida. He's a 230-pound guy. He's not going to come and do like Placid or Penticton just because it doesn't make sense for him.
No, too much climbing, yeah.
Too much climbing. So you got to have a variety of different events. And the other thing to us was we're always trying to figure out what's the right amount of events. How do you keep this thing unique and special?
Yes.
Like, we, you know, I laugh now because, like, I remember when we had like a fourth or fifth event, you'd go on these forums and people saying we're killing the sport by oversaturating it. I'm going, oh my gosh. Like, you know, five events and we were getting that feedback.
There's 45 now. 45 fulls and 105
70.3s. Yeah, now there's 45.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you sit and go, you know, I reflect back on all the things that we used to live and the athletes and all that, but you know, it really is an amazing sport. It was really fun to be involved with. Really, really fun.
What the other thing I remember back, especially with Ironman California, is I remember some of the folks on the military base asking me my thoughts on, you know, where they should do it. And we raced a lot at Del Mar Beach, right? We did these short triathlons at Del Mar Beach. And, you know, I was like, God, you do the swim there, and then you bike, and you can do the run. You can, if you wanted. They were convinced, like you said, they wanted a second transition because they wanted the whole base to be involved. And I'm like, well, if you're going to do that, that's fine. But, you know, that area is really be a tough run. But I remember your thought was, and you were totally spot on, if I put people in Del Mar Beach with those 8 to 10 foot waves, you know, half my field will be out of the race before the swim is over.
Right, right.
Yeah, being in a bay was really, really special.
Yeah, the bay worked, other than the measurement, which
that was hilarious. Nautical miles,
yeah, the
baby.
Nautical miles. And, you know, the guys measured and they came back, and these are military guys. You
right.
trust them. Kept
yes.
saying it is 2.4. So I actually went out and swam. It was a two loop swim. So it was half. So I went out and swam the thing. And I came in and I was like, God, like my time is really, I mean, I'm not a great swimmer, but I just like, I'm not that bad. Like, how come I'm so slow? And, you know, but they say it's spot on. And you know, maybe it's the conditions, the current, you're sort of analyzing it. So we let them go. And then they decided it was an nautical mile. So,
well, I remember Brian Rhodes came out in about an hour or something. Right. And
normally
these guys
are
50 minutes.
An hour, you go, okay, something.
Nautical miles, sir. It's 2.4, exactly 2.4 nautical miles. So when you look back at the growth, right, you said people were going, oh, God, four events, five events, it's too many. When did you feel there was saturation? Or during your time, did you feel there was too many events?
No, I didn't think we had too many events because, you know, every event we put on sold out in literally 5 minutes.
Yes.
So
yep.
I don't think, you know, and part of it, there's two different ways, you know, I would look at it. And again, I mean, I was an independent guy putting it on. Now it's, you know, it's a corporation who has to have growth, and it's a different business model. And
sure.
I'm not judging. It's just the way it is.
Right.
So how you analyze it might be different. I always thought of it, if you have too many, where do you lose the point where it's not special to be an Ironman now?
That's true.
If
yes.
everyone's done it, what, you know, does it demean the, you know, the what you're doing to be an Ironman? So like, so there's the business side, then there's the human side. So, and you, somehow you're trying to blend the two, right? So, I think it seems like the sport might be leveled off now, or actually being at a little bit of a decline right now, because of competition from other sports. But, we didn't last long enough to actually know what we would have done with it, like what our saturation point was. I'm sure we would have added another event or two, but I guarantee we wouldn't be where they are now. Like, we
right.
never would have done how many there are. Because I would have at some point said, I don't think it's special when you do that. And we don't need to keep growing, because that's not what an independent person has to do.
So as a guy who had done over 300 triathlons, how important was that for you in terms of determining the, you know, going into a market and going, this works, right? This swim is going to be special. The bike, 'cause I agree with you. When you're going to do something like the Ironman, you want to know that it's an A swim, A bike, A run. You don't want to go and do some convoluted out and back type of thing.
Right.
How
right,
important was right. being an athlete and being an Ironman guy in terms of you coming in and going, thumbs up, this is the right place to be?
Well, I think it's very important. I think your personal experiences lead to a lot of your decisions in your life. And, you know, and not just being an athlete, but when you're an athlete, you're hanging around athletes. So you've got this feedback from all the people that you train with, and you sense what they like and don't like. And so just being in that environment, you know, I can't imagine not being a triathlete and coming in trying to make the decisions on courses and venues and just even the whole product. Like, you know, we believed in the banquets and the whole creating this atmosphere of
yes.
specialness. Like, why I believed in the banquets so much, because I remember in 1984 when I sat in Kona, and at the little banquet that was out at the Kona Surf. At the other end, Kona Surf. Like, but, you know, I was 23 years old, and I was, you know, glossy-eyed at seeing Dave Scott up there, and, you know, and we're all gathered in this one spot. It gave me this energy to do my event. And that, so I remember that. So that's why it was very important when we developed the whole business model product to keep, you know, bigger banquets and the videos and the inspiration and the human stories. Because, you know, I always felt it was our job to get them, when they hit that water, the next morning or 2 mornings later that they were so pumped and this was meaningful to them. So that comes from, you know, my own experience. And, in the swim bike run stuff, I was always, you know, I always was like, to me, you know, Paula would always say, I know she'd always tell people, Graham would always say, it's the most important thing, swim bike run.
Right.
Like
yes.
All the other stuff, if you screw up swim bike run, nothing else matters. So you have to find, you know, those courses that are safe and, you know, have all those little characteristics that an athlete would want. So, I never believed in just taking a check from a community and putting a race in there and trying to fudge it to work.
Yeah, because like that's not
never going to fly.
No, it doesn't last long term. It's not going to be successful.
No, it's not going to last long term. And I guess part of it is like, I don't know how to say this, but when you put your name on it, like our generation of race directors.
Yes.
And I said this in my Hall of Fame speech. It was always a Terry Davis race, a Fred Summers race, a Graham Frey. Like you, it's your pride. It's your name.
Yes, true.
You're not an entity. You're not a hidden entity that no one knows. You're the entity. You're the one that they know your face. They know your name, and they're going to find you. So you have your pride on the line. So you might approach it a little different, going, you know what? I always had a high standard. That it sounds arrogant, but I say when someone did my races, I want them to walk away saying, when they go to his race, it's always the best race. It's always, you know, they take care of everything, and that was a motivating factor. And that's from being an athlete. Like when I played hockey or I played golf, it was always, I want to do the best I can. That doesn't change when you become an event director or, you know, I don't necessarily think it's just a race director, but you were doing the whole business side. It had to be that level.
It
motivates you.
The other thing that I find fascinating is back in the day, you knew that at the end of the day, you got to get new people into the sport. So you had, for the Ironman events, you had kids events. You had when you had your event series before, you had your try. They were full weekends. They were triathlon festivals. It's funny because that's been my big push with USA Triathlon. It says, guys, you got to give people a lot of opportunities. You got to have aqua bike.
Yes.
You got to have kids events. The more the merrier. You got the roads blocked off anyways. Get people in.
Right.
We want to be a welcome mat for everybody. But you had that vision early on. Did that, again, come from being, you know, I was a hockey player, I was a golfer. I want everybody to be part of this.
Well, yeah, it's always been my life kind of mandate and, you know, something in me. I don't even know why, but I just believe I love sports so much and it means so much to my life. And it gives me, even at this age, I wake up every day. I can't, you know, after we get off this call, I'm going for my run.
Like, right.
I just, it makes you feel alive. And I think people, for help, physical health, mental health, all those things, you need those things. And you have to give people opportunity. Like everything is about how do you give people opportunity. So, you know, if you don't have kids races, they don't experience it. You know, if you don't do the try-a-tries and this, like, you've got to give them all opportunities. And that was kind of I don't know if it was necessarily a brilliant business. It's just something you believed in. And if you believe in it, you do it and you put it in your product and it makes it a better for everyone. So that's just kind of what all evolved. And I do think, you just said right now, I was talking to the USAT president about a year and a half ago, because, you know, the sports, I think, having a little
been
more
flat,
trouble growing
and
getting
down.
People in
yep.
right now, and they're just brainstorming. I said, you know, I watch what's going on in the world right now, and I see all the obstacle races, and I think we've got a whole societal shift going on where people are more recreational versus competitive.
Yes,
I think,
agree.
There's always competitive people. There's always going to be competitive, but I think in the masses and the numbers, it's much more record. Like I look at my kids' generation, very few of them compete. They go skiing and they go ride their mountain bikes in the woods and they do things, but they don't compete. So how do you transform that into triathlon? And you know, maybe you know, if USAT and some of these federations had 200 bikes that took a trailer to Chicago on the waterfront weekend and set up a little fun little swim bike, and you know, people just go out and try it.
Yes.
Like, you know, you have to do innovative things to get people in the sport.
Well,
you can't just put up the sign and hope people show up.
I agree. And I look at it as an endurance entertainment marketplace with Tough Mudder and Spartan Race and Warrior Dash and Color Run. And then we still have marathons and triathlons and Grand Fondos. So there's a lot of opportunity for people to put a number on. And there's more people putting on numbers than ever before. But when you look at triathlon, it's expensive. It's equipment intensive.
Yes.
It's time intensive. The swim you can die in. The bike ride is, you know, again, is expensive, and that could be hazardous as well. So we have to do the right things to get people in and make them feel secure do the open water swim practices, the transition work, all that. It's the hard yards.
Yeah.
You forget the social media part, and you go, we need to make sure people feel comfortable doing this. And, you know, that stuff takes time and effort, which sometimes people don't want to do. So I want to get into something else. I want to get into Gino Bartoli.
Okay.
And you've moved into a different chapter in your life, and you saw this script on Gino. And take me through that. When were you exposed to this story, and what was it about this story that moved you so much?
Well, you know, I was reading I always read the paper every day, and I was reading the Saturday Globe and Mail in Toronto, and they did a book review on a book called Road to Valor.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, so I read the review, and it's a cycling story about Gino Bartoli, which I'll get into in a minute. And, you know, so I basically drove right up to the Chapters, the bookstore, and I got the book. And as I was reading the book, I could just basically see a movie playing out. Like, the story was incredible, like all the different pieces. And, you know, it's not just a cycling story.
No.
You know, there's a lot to it. So anyway, fast-tracking this, I'll give you the cliff notes on this.
Yeah.
My daughter works in the film industry, and she was working on a movie called Transcendence out in New Mexico. So Sue and I, and I think Luke, our son, went with us and went out to visit her. And we go on set, and, you know, Andrew Kotsoff was with Alcon, the owner of Alcon, who makes the movies. He, you know, he's an Iron Man guy, and him and I went for a run. And he, just out of the blue, he said to me, man, I'd like to make a movie with cycling as a backdrop someday.
And I, oh, my God.
I literally just finished the book. So I told Andrew the story and took him through it. He goes, does anybody own the film rights? And I said, I have no idea. So anyway, I went back and, you know, went on Facebook, of all things, and sent a note to the authors, who happened to be living in New York, but they're from Toronto, and they'd been to Iron Man's and actually knew who I was. So I went to New York and had a meeting with them. They had already sold the movie rights to a company called Anonymous Content in L.A. But they said, why don't you talk to them and see if, you know, you could get involved with them and help push it along.
Sure.
So I went out to L.A. Anyway, I called them today. I went out to L.A., met them, and they went out twice. And anyway, long story short, we ended up buying the movie rights from them. And they're still a partner. Like, they own some of it, but we're the majority. And yeah, actually, I have a call with them today, too. But we've partnered up on it, and they had been talking to some writers already. So we, you know, long story short, we ended up writing a script, and, you know, we're in the, you know, it's a long process, but we're in the development phase. And we've got a line producer who happened to be an Ironman athlete, who's a great, you know, line producer who's helping us with the budgets and all the, how you do the, as they call it, the international TV rights and other movie rights. So it's been a real learning curve. But, you know, maybe I don't know, yeah, do you want me to talk about the story?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the story is fascinating.
Yeah, Gino Bartoli is a, you know, I've said this story a lot of times. I'll give you the two-minute version. He, Italian cyclist back in the Second World War area, poor peasant from Florence, Italy, worked at a local bike shop at 10 years old. And then this Jewish fellow named Goldberg came in, and he really could see this kid loved bikes, but he had no money, so he bought him a bike. He bought Gino a bike. And then Gino starts riding the bike and, you know, fast-tracking into his teenage years, becomes a really good junior cyclist. Ends up winning the Giro d'Italia in 1938. Ends up winning the Tour de France in 1938. When the Second World War broke out, there was no cycling events going on, but he continued to train. And there was a cardinal in Assisi, Italy, Cardinal Della Costa, who had a friend in Assisi that made fake passports, had a machine that would make fake passports. And they convinced Gino to be the bike courier to deliver the fake passports to the Jewish people.
Wow.
Through the Second World War era. And he basically did this through the Second World War. He'd go into his training, and what it allowed him to do was his celebrity. Because even the Germans and, you know, all the fascists knew who Gino was, and they would want pictures with him. And he actually made up cards, like almost like a baseball card, so that he could sign autographs to these people, because he used his celebrity. And they were catching on to him. And he would put the passports in the tubes of his bikes.
Wow.
And then he would go deliver them to people. So he risked his life every day. And really, it's a story about him and Mussolini and the fascists, you know, in that era, because they controlled his biking career, too, what events he did, what he did. And he would stand up to the fascists, and then he became the passport guy. It's a very dramatic story. There's a lot of drama, and they're going to catch him or not, and those type of things. And anyway, after the Second World War ends, Gino goes back to training, and he's now a lot older, and everyone's calling him the old man. And along the way, the part I missed was his brother died in a bike race.
Oh, that's right.
Basically, the estranged. His father was estranged from Gino because he really blamed Gino for getting his brother into bike racing. And his brother was the academic, and he was going to be the one to lead the family out of poverty because he was the smart one. And so there was a lot of family turmoil with his brother dying. And Gino really took it hard, too, because his brother and him were, like, best friends and soulmates. So anyway, in 1948, he's at the Tour de France, and he's not doing very well. This is his comeback. The media is beating him up. You know, there's a lot. And Italy's in shambles after the Second World War.
Sure.
Like, complete shambles. So there's the greatest scene is, like, there's two stages to go, and he's in Confront, heading into the couple mountain stages, and he gets a phone call from the president of Italy basically saying, we need you to do something, Gino, in the mountains, you know, to lift the morale of the country. We need you to do something special, and da-da-da. So anyway, he hangs up. He goes down to the lobby of the hotel, and there's his father standing there, who he hasn't, you know, really had a relationship with for a long, long time. And Gino had lost a son, too, along the way, a stillborn son. So the father gives him this big hug and says, you know, Gino, you lost a son. I lost a son. You go into those mountains and you race for our sons. Like, wow. You know, you read the script and you're crying when you read it.
Yeah.
And it's all a true story. And anyway, he wakes up the next day and it's snowing out in the mountains. Like, it's just the worst weather. Like, this is July, you know. And what that allowed him to do is, Gino's so tough and, you know, he's got the seniority. And the young guys all just, you know, basically couldn't handle the conditions. And long story short, Gino does two stages in the mountains through all the snow and whatever, and he ends up winning the Tour de France again.
Wow.
He rides into Paris and he wins.
Wow. In between 10 years after he won his last one.
Yeah, 10 years after, which is still a record to this day. And, you know, and then, you know, the country's celebrating and it lifts the spirits of Italy. And it's just like one of those things. What interests me was, like, I mean, A, I love sports and I love cycling, but B, the humanity of this guy to risk his life.
Yes.
And even though, you know, he never told the story, how the story got broke as he became an older man was the Jewish people started talking about it. All the families he had saved, you know, and their kids and everything, started talking about this Italian cyclist who saved their family. So he was so humble, and he always basically told his kids that, you know, you don't do things for people to talk about, you notice, you do it because it's the right thing. Like, and that's how he led his life. And which is, you know, I don't know if we've lost that in our society. I mean, sure, there's a lot of people who do that, but it's one of those things I believe every person should remember that message. And that's what interests me in the film, is to see this man who, you know, especially after we went through the whole land, all the drug scandals and cycling, you need an uplifting story of something about better humanity.
Wow. What an amazing story. What an amazing guy. And the fact that after the war, that nobody even knew about it. How long was it before that became public knowledge?
Oh, decades.
Wow.
Like, the guy, you know, he kept this internal, like, you know, because it wasn't why he did it.
Right.
You know, he saved, like, thousands of lives. And there's a shrine in Israel now with him. Like, you know, so that once the story broke, you know, it became this thing, and then, you know, the media jumped on it and did it. So, you know, to me, it's like, it's a great book to read, but it's, you know, and that's why we just want to make this film so the world can know this wonderful story.
That's amazing. And so where does it stand now? I read the script, which was phenomenal. I know that, you know, obviously it's one of those things, getting a film made in Hollywood is, you know, so difficult.
It's a five-day-year process. which I'm not normally wired for. I like to do things right away. But,
yes.
We're rewriting the script right now. We're working with different production companies, distribution companies. How you work in the film industry, you know, it's always about getting money and the financing, and you do pre-sales in Europe, things like that. Then you get some investors to put money in, and then the banks put in the rest. So we're in a good place right now. Like, we've got most of the pieces put together, and, you know, hopefully we'll be rolling cameras in the next 18 months.
So when this film gets made, we need to do a premiere here in Southern California.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the cycling hubs. A lot of things started in California, including triathlon.
Exactly. Hey, Graham, first of all, give our best to Sue. Thank you so much for taking time. Congrats on everything you've accomplished. Triathlon would not be where it's at now if it wasn't for you and Sue and all your hard work. And just like, here we, this event, we're $350,000 in debt. We're going to lose another $100,000. Where do I sign? That's the understanding the power of this sport and where it was going to go before anybody else did. That's really special. I appreciate all your time, buddy.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. It's great catching up, and I love staying in touch with you and talking about you know, all the wonderful things we got this year.
Go V's, right? Is your hockey team going on right now?
Yeah, we got a game tonight. We're actually on the road tonight, and a game tomorrow night. Team's doing well, so it's that's the other project I love is the hockey world. So it's been a lot of fun.
That is so cool, especially because you grew up as a hockey player, to be able to own your own team in Penticton, where you know where Ironman got going. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. I mean, you know, again, I always look back when I was sitting at my desk in high school. Would you have ever believed, you know, when I was a junior, would I ever get to own a team and be part of it? And you know, and it's just fun because it's no different than triathlon. To see these kids move on to college or the NHL and those things, it's really wonderful. Anytime you can give athletes an opportunity, and it's a blessing you get to be involved with it.
Have you had some of the kids come through the V's and now are in the NHL?
Oh, I think we have 9 boys in the NHL right now. Like 9 V's are in the NHL.
Very cool.
Paul Kariya was just inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame, and he was a Penticton player. So it's quite a legacy. That was way before me. But there's a lot of legacy to junior hockey in this town, and to be able to continue that. And, we're getting 3,500 fans a game in this little town, so it's really become the thing. So it's just it's a lot of fun.
Great. Graham Frazier has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, ATVSwimSpas.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've sent out 2,448 grants last year, totaling $3.7 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.